Well, I'm going to assume that as soon as we get started, more people will show up. It's a sort of the law of nature. I'm David George Gordon, and I live in Seattle, Washington. And so it wasn't that big a trip for me to get here. Oh, it's still about a three-hour drive in a very different environment because it's on the other side of the mountains. So the way things work in Washington is all the clouds come drifting in off the ocean. They get snagged by those mountains. They rain. The west side of the state is very wet, and further east you go, it's drier. So we're just right at kind of the start of where it gets progressively drier and drier. If you were to continue west from here, you'd see that it was really an arid part of the state. And that's because of the rain, literally the rain shadow of that, that the mountains are grabbing the clouds. It's a great place to talk about what we're going to talk about today, which is watershed. And actually, I was thinking it was a nice way of tying in with Ezekiel on the theme here, but I wasn't really aware until I actually started doing my research on this area how germane that actually is because of the work that they're doing to remediate what's going on with the leftovers from mining, the mining tailings and all that. So in just a second, we'll talk more about that. I thought it would be a good idea to actually make this more of a conversation and less of a lecture. So you all get to participate in this too. And probably you may already know each other, but in case that you don't, I certainly don't. Let's go around and say our names and where we're from. So let's start with you.
I'm Brenda, and I'm from Waffle, Washington, which is just east of Seattle.
Yeah.
I'm Doug from Kirkland, Washington.
All right, Washington.
Yes. Bev from Southern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Dana from Ortona, Minnesota.
Okay.
Barb, I grew up in Minnesota, but for 22 years I've been in North Carolina.
Oh.
Inga from South Dakota.
Okay.
And I'm Bjorn from Seattle.
All right. How about you guys?
Ann from Duluth, Minnesota.
From Arden. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Well, I'm from Duluth, Minnesota.
All right. I believe in that.
Kirsten from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Bruce also from Minneapolis.
Alan from Newark, Delaware.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have a pretty broad range. I'd say Minnesota. Oh, I'm sorry.
Back here.
Oh, hello.
I'm Sharon from Bellevue, Washington.
Okay.
And I'm Peter from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
I'm Amy. I'm like you. I grew up in Minnesota, but for the last 22 years, for 4 years, I've been living out here. I'm from Portland.
Okay.
Bullhorn Watershed.
All right. And this gentleman who's just joining us, what's your name?
Roger.
Where are you from? Roger.
Waffle.
Okay. So we have a bunch of Washingtonians here, which is nice because that's probably an area I know a lot more about than I do about Minnesota. And it's nice to have a really good representation of Midwesterners because, you know, whether you know it or not, you live in a watershed.
I know we do.
Okay, good. Yeah, how many of you are familiar with that term, watershed?
Yes.
Okay. I have to tell you, I got started studying about watersheds. This was in 1998. And it was interesting to me. I was actually hired to work on a project. In 1998, the state of Washington actually passed a law that said that all of the counties that bordered Puget Sound is a saltwater body of water that they're trying to protect. So all the 12 counties around there needed to do watershed planning to control non-point pollution. So it meant that all the counties had to identify watersheds in their area, and they also needed to talk about non-point pollution and how to prevent it. Well, here I had this new assignment as a writer, which is what I do for a living. And I, my first two questions were, well, what is a watershed, and what is non-point pollution? It's something I hadn't really, wasn't really very familiar with when I started this project. But, of course, a year and a half later, I wound up writing a sort of a handbook for people who are doing the planning itself, the things that they needed to consider. And these are all identified by state law, what they needed to consider in their plan. So I wrote this handbook. It took me quite some time. And I really learned a lot about the wisdom of watersheds. The definition of a watershed is really interesting to me. It's actually all the land that drains water into one common area. it's pretty easy to see while we're up here in the mountain peaks. But, you know, you go along a ridge, the water's going to flow one way on one side of the ridge and down the other way on another. Well, if you start from that high point of that ridge, and everything that flows down into here, basically into Railroad Creek, would be considered one watershed. There are lots of smaller creeks that feed into Railroad Creek. And then where does Railroad Creek flow into? It goes into Lake Chelan. So that actually is a Railroad Creek watershed. That's what the planning that's going on right now with the mine tailings is all about. But I also picked up this book in the store here. This is a guide. This is a guide to Lake Chelan watershed. So it's kind of like, how do you want to slice that? Some people would say that all of Lake Chelan is one big watershed because everything that drains into Lake Chelan would be contributing to that. And then there are people who divide that up. And then there's lots of kind of nomenclature struggles over whether, are we talking about basins within a watershed, like King County, where Seattle is located, and Bothell as well. King County has a whole system of basins that they created. They have basin stewards, people who go out to make sure that those parts of the county are safe. They're pretty much identical to watersheds. They could have sub-basins. There are all sorts of little divisions for the sake of planning. But the really smart thing about watersheds and why I like them so much is they're natural systems. It's not like, I mean, we have all these ridiculous examples of where someone drew a line almost with a piece of chalk to create a border for a state or a county. Sometimes they use a river, half of the river. Like, you know, those of you in Portland, we have the Columbia River. Half of the Columbia River is Washington, the other half. It's kind of arbitrary, and it may have made sense for political purposes, but it doesn't make a lot of sense for the way things really work. The other thing that's wonderful about watersheds is everybody who lives within a watershed is pretty much interconnected by that hydrology, the way the water flows across and under the ground. So if you have somebody in one corner of the watershed that's doing something that's polluting, it basically is going to contribute to pollution throughout the watershed, more or less. That's where this expression, and I put that in my project description, we all live downstream, comes from. Because basically we're all responsible for actions, but we also are recipients of actions throughout the watershed. One action can affect the entire watershed. So I thought when I started working on this, wow, this is neat. I like that as a planning area. The other thing is, now that we've discussed what a watershed is, let's talk about non-point pollution. I've always had a lot of humor in describing things in terms of what they aren't. That's kind of an odd thing, non-point pollution. It's kind of vertebrates and invertebrates, you know, animals with backbones, animals without backbones. In the case of invertebrates, 90% of our planet is an animal without a backbone. Because we have backbones, we like to call them the ones without backbones. So we're defining something by what it doesn't have. And it's easy to explain what non-point pollution is in terms of what it isn't. So we look at point source pollution. Point source pollution means you can pretty much find a discrete point where that pollution comes from. A sewer pipe, let's say, or industrial outfall or something like that. And that's a point source of pollution. A lot of the point sources were regulated with the Clean Water Act. That was in the 1970s. And every now and then they passed new amendments or they reauthorized the Clean Water Act. But it really looked at discharges, like from paper mills, for example, and said you can only throw so much pollution out without putting in some kinds of controls. So they put a lot of constraints on the point sources of pollution. But non-point pollution is pollution that comes from sources where you can't really find one particular spot. And actually the mine tailings here are probably a great example, because when it rains really hard and it's washing, I think iron in this case, out of the rock and into the creek, that's coming from a really broad area. It's not like we can just, you know, put the brakes on it and stop it from happening. So that's where non-point pollution comes from. And I'm curious, if you think about it, what are some examples, if you all have one you want to shout out, your favorite source, non-point source pollution, what might be some examples of places where we can't really nail it down. Anyone have some
fertilizers?
What's that?
Fertilizers.
Yeah, fertilizer, definitely. And there's a lot of campaigns now about, they say, don't give your lawn a chemical dependency. If you go out and put lots of chemicals on your lawn, and then it rains and washes all of that stuff into a lake or into a creek or whatever, it's not a good time.
Also, the spray on the farms up in Minnesota, they spray all their crops for weeds.
Yeah, so that's really kind of a pesticide runoff is basically what we're talking about. Most of these things are like things they're everyday activities. Anybody else want to throw one in here?
Air pollution.
Well, yeah, air pollution, and then we have acid rain. When rain comes through, the air pollution, it brings it down to the land again in a liquid form.
In Minnesota, the chemicals to keep the roads from being slippery in the winter.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's interesting to me that there's lots of ones that we have lots of struggle with because we're not necessarily going to control them right away. Agricultural chemicals, for example. You know, there's a lot of arguments why those are important to use. But controlling them so that they don't get into water bodies is really important and pollute out a whole area.
I know a lot of people that won't drink their water from their wells that live close to the farms with all of that. We have a lot of cancer in Minnesota, and they're afraid that that's where the cancer is coming from.
Yeah. Alan, did you want to say something?
Yeah, that's good. In Delaware, it's one of the places where there are, Southern Delaware has a lot of chicken farms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the chicken manure is not just industrial chicken farms in Delaware, but it's big beef producers in Colorado and pork producers in Colorado. It's industrial agriculture as opposed to local agriculture.
Yeah, and I should also say that, you know, it's interesting, but in some ways those industrial feedlots where they have lots and lots of cows crammed together, those are actually considered point sources of pollution.
Okay.
But on the other hand, if you have a cow that's wandering around and it goes into a stream that's unfenced and poops, now that's a non-point source of pollution. Someone in the back had one. Did you have something you want to say?
I'm from Illinois.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Flatlander. Uh-huh. Flatlander. Farm. Nephew feeds out probably 3,000 to 4,000 head a year. He keeps track of every field he spreads manure on. He rents ground to put manure on.
Mm-hmm.
So I might be in the minority, but I'm sticking up for the guy with the big herd.
Okay. Well, and I don't think the game here is to find bad guys.
No,
you know, basically,
not.
We all contribute. That's the thing that's so ironic. In some way, we're all contributing to non-point pollution. And so someone said to me, when you point a finger, there's three fingers pointing back at you, right? So it doesn't really pay to say, you know, these people need to be controlled. The real point is, people that have feedlots, they're already controlled a lot by the federal government. And the people that go out and, oh, I don't know, wash their car, for example, and let the water, the soap and the oil and all the stuff they just washed off aren't controlled by the government. There's no law about that. Although in Washington State, there's now a really big campaign, go to a car wash. Don't just wash your car. And there's also people that go and stencil storm drains. You know, water runs down to a drain that says, you know, please be clean. This drain goes to a stream. And we have all those salmon running through a lot of our streams, so we definitely don't want pollution there. Well, I started writing down some of the ones I could think of, and some of them are surprising. The agriculture is definitely can be a source of non-point pollution. And ironically, it's also a fact that the small-scale farms, in fact, we hobbyists, if we're told to go out and use a chemical, there's a standard practice, it seems, that, well, if it says you're going to use a cup of this chemical, let's double the dose and really get those things. Well, a commercial farmer wouldn't do that because it's costly. And they know a lot more about this. But it's the amateurs, actually, that create a lot of problems by in their own gardens, you know, using lawn chemicals of all sorts. And then, you know, tripling the dose so it would be effective. So agriculture is one, but you know what's really a big issue is soil erosion. That's something that, you know, we all know about from the 1930s, the Dust Bowl. Once they start digging up the land and making it into cropland, it's real easy for rain and wind to come and blow the top layer of soil off. And where does it go? Eventually, it could go into the creek and choke out all the life in the creek, basically. So there's a lot of emphasis nowadays on controlling that kind of erosion. And, you know, the same thing is true with home building, really. Once they clear the land, and then they, oh, gee, we couldn't really get our financing right away, so we're going to wait a year. Well, that land is now devoid of any ground cover. So it's all that land is exposed to. It's not just farming that's the problem for that. It could be home building as well. The other one that I think is fascinating are septic systems. In where, the area where I live, Puget Sound area, a lot of people have bought, like, wilderness cabins or shoreline property where they want to get away from it all. And the septic systems there may or may not work very well. If they have a septic tank and a drain field, you know, everyone's poop goes into that tank, gets distributed through the drain field, and if it was installed incorrectly or it wasn't maintained correctly, then all of a sudden you have some of that runoff. You have lots of nutrients that are flowing through the ground, basically, and right into bodies of water. Once you get those nutrients in the water, it actually feeds algae. The algae goes, oh, great, plant food, grows like crazy, then eventually it crashes, it dies. And all the dead algae actually robs the oxygen out of the water. I think I have to say at this point, in other words, it's complicated. There's a lot of different ways that our own everyday actions contribute. Yeah?
I just thought of a couple more. I don't know whether the CSL problem in Oregon, the combined sewer overflow, when the sewer system gets rain in it, it floods and the effluent goes right into the river. What's the other one? Oh, yeah, the stuff we put in our laundry. Borax is is toxic to life.
Well, again, it's everyday stuff. Household chemicals. You know, I only have a little bit of this pine salt left. I think I'll dump it down the drain. Well, where is it going to go? Eventually it goes through our systems. And now more recently they're saying even things like, I don't know, birth control pills.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of
pharmaceuticals,
they go through us. They go into our septic systems or our toilets, and eventually they do work their way into the watershed. And birth control pills are actually starting to have an effect on the fertility of the fish that we like to catch and eat. Yeah. I know, hard to imagine
that.
Well, that's true. What's that?
Diapers,
yeah.
Diapers,
that's right.
Yeah. When our kids are little, it was cloth ones.
Yeah.
Oh, but even cloth diapers have an impact. We use cloths.
Yeah, I guess they do.
Well, we could get depressed here because it's going to have an impact. And it's true. As a species, we are kind of an impactful species. Mm-hmm. You know, long, long time ago, Native Americans had an impact as well. It's kind of unrealistic to say they didn't, because they actually would burn down prairies so they could have a better view of the enemy coming. And, you know, they hunted, they fished, but their numbers were relatively few compared to what we have today. And also the fact that more and more people, well, we always like to grouse about this, more people are moving into the western states. And for the first time in U.S. history, more people live on the west coast than on the east coast. It's a east coast state, that is. More and more people are moving to coastal areas, which puts them a lot closer and more in danger of pollution. But you wouldn't think living way up here you'd be affecting Lake Chelan. But of course you are, big time. That's one of the things that I think Colvin Village does a really good job of, making sure that they're not having as much impact considering how many people go through here.
Well, there is in Alaska with the tsunami from Japan is coming.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get rid of all of that.
That's right. There's a global influences as well. And this gentleman who mentioned air pollution, there's been studies that show that a lot of the pollution that drops from the sky into the United States is actually originating in China. So it's carried by whatever that is, the Gulf Stream, air winds, yeah, trade winds, that's what I meant, all the way over here. So, you know, no man is an island, particularly when it comes to pollution. Well, the other ones I want to mention, because I think they're really fascinating, one of them is stormwater runoff. That's actually what the people in the Puget Sound area have determined is the single biggest thing. When it rains, it can hit what we call impervious surfaces. We're talking about roofs. We're talking about sidewalks. We're talking about streets where they've actually, it's not going to sink into the land. The natural system is the rain should sink into the land, maybe go into groundwater that's far down where we actually get that through wells again. That would be the natural system. As soon as we start paving things over, now we're creating some problems because all that water has to go somewhere. And people used to build houses where their drains would just pretty much go right onto the ground or into a pipe and then into the water. Now, of course, you have all sorts of restrictions on where your drains from your roof are going to go.
We have to have sump pumps in Minnesota to catch all the water. I used to have, when it rained, we'd have a big pond all the way around between our houses. Since I put my sump pump in, and the neighbor said it too, there's no pond out there anymore.
Yes.
So I don't really know exactly why. I know it. They don't want it to go through the system. But that would be rainwater, I think.
Yeah. Well, and the weirdest thing is that the stormwater we're talking about is actually coming off of highways oftentimes. And highways are full of oil. I mean, I have to confess, my car leaks a little oil from time to time. I have to go and get it fixed and replace the oil. When you go in and you say, put a little, oh, they say, oh, it's a little low. Well, where did it go? It either burned up and went out as aromatic hydrocarbons in the air, or it went onto the road. And all that stuff on the road is going to build up. There's also a big war about brake lining. The brake linings, which, of course, you know, your brakes are wearing out. You need, well, where's all that going? It's actually a lot of heavy metals, actually, in those brake linings, copper and things like that, that are now going into water bodies and creating problems. So, well, we all know this. By driving cars, we're contributing to some issues, pollution issues, in one way or another. But it's amazing to me that they've actually identified that storm water, the water that hits the impervious surfaces, and flows into a water body is actually the biggest enemy of Puget Sound right now. It's not the paper mills or the factories or what have you. It's the stuff that's coming from our everyday activities. The other one I wrote down on this list was, we talked about this briefly, land conversion. That there's natural systems in place. And like I see this a lot in Seattle. I bet you see this in where you live in Minnesota as well. Once they take an area that used to be rural or wooded and they turn it into housing projects and all that, they've increased the amount of impervious surfaces, they've opened up the amount of erosion possibilities, they've really changed the way the hydrology, the way the water works in those watersheds, big time. And as our populations keep growing, we all love to have new homes and bigger homes and things like that. It's really starting to take its toll.
One thing about that in Minnesota, because there are so many lakes, there's so many second homes, you know, cabins.
Yeah.
And so that really changes. And then people walk their lawns down to the lake. And so there's a big movement to try to get the lake edges back to native
vegetation. Yeah, that's a really good point. I definitely might get to back to that in a little bit. I turned it out and vastly underestimated how many people would want to come indoors on a beautiful day like today. So you all need to share probably one amongst three. Here's just a schematic diagram. You're welcome to keep one. We'll start over here. And let's just pass these around. Schematic diagram that shows here's how a creek flows and all the things that are going to go into it within one watershed. I mean, here the Lake Chelan watershed, it's fairly simple. There's two major water rivers that flow into Lake Chelan. One of them is Railroad Creek right here. Another one comes out of Stehekin, the Stehekin River. And neither of them have, you know, they don't have municipal areas. They don't have a lot of car traffic. They don't have a lot of those kind of things that are going to plague some of the urban watersheds. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the difference, because I think this is really important, between an urban watershed. How many of you live in bigger towns or big cities? And then how many of you live in kind of rural, little towns? Okay. It's really interesting to me how the dynamics are so different. And I live in Seattle in an area called the Thornton Creek Watershed. It's actually the largest watershed in the Seattle area. And I live right on Thornton Creek, so I get to watch the creek rise and fall when it rains, for example. Well, in urban areas where there's lots of that impervious surfaces, when it rains, the water goes right into the creek. The creek goes up 6 feet, and then it goes back down again the next day. So they don't have the natural systems that meager it out. It goes into the soil and very gradually goes in. They pretty much removed all those natural systems. And you can see an enormous difference right there. One of the things that I looked at, which I thought was really amazing, I had actually had to write this down because, first of all, I looked at it twice. I couldn't believe the actual numbers. There's a phenomenon. Here's those of you who love words. You won't be able to use this in a Scrabble game. I'm sorry. Too big. But the word is evapotranspiration. Isn't that a great word? What does that mean? Well, it means that the water that goes into the ground gets absorbed by trees, right? The trees pull up that water. That's why you need to go back out and water again later, maybe, if you're growing and stuff. It goes up through the tree, it goes into the leaves, and it actually leaves the leaves and goes into the atmosphere. So a tree is pulling up water. I had looked this up online before I gave this talk today. And not just trees, but any plants. An acre of corn pulls anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of water per day through evapotranspiration, and it removes it and puts it back into the clouds, and then it becomes back down as rain again. A large oak tree, 40,000 gallons in a year. That's one tree. You remove five of those oak trees, and now you have, 200,000 gallons of water standing around that weren't standing around before. So what we do to change the lay of the land is really pretty profound. It's kind of amazing. It's a great argument for why we should be out planting more trees, maybe. I don't know. But that's kind of amazing. And that whole business of changing the land in terms of impervious surfaces, but also in terms of the natural vegetation that was there, changing that. Sometimes we put in plants that they're non-native plants. They don't really provide the same services in terms of habitat and food for plants and other animals. And we can really change the way things work. And in cities, it's kind of amazing to me. The Thornton Creek I was talking about before originally was like a cranberry bog way up creek. And then when it rained, the water would go down this creek, kind of meander this way down, and went into Lake Washington. Well, nowadays, that cranberry bog is underneath a parking lot for a shopping mall. They actually recently started what they call daylighting these areas that have been covered, and they created a little bit of a marsh, simulated marsh, in the midst of this area that was once all stores and shopping mall and paved paradise and put up a parking lot. So that's a major change. But even where it comes down to the bottom, and this is what I was going to get back to, where the creek meets the water, you often have wetlands. Well, you used to have wetlands. We've lost 70% of our nation's wetlands. They're actually, even during the original Bush administration, there was a no net loss of wetlands. Where you're going to stand firm and not lose wetlands. And why is that? It's because the wetlands themselves provide an incredible service. They not only absorb water, so it's, instead of the water's rushing down this natural system, it gets to the wetland and it gets slowed very much by the wetlands that are there. It also works the other direction too, and I think New Orleans, when it was hit by Hurricane Katrina, would have been a lot less vulnerable if it had more of its natural wetlands around, because the water going that way would have been slowed as well. But the real point is, when it goes through the wetland, those plants take out a lot of the pollution. They actually capture the soil and the erosion and the chemicals and what have you in those wetland areas, and the plants very slowly take up a lot of that and break it down. So that's another real advantage. Of course, there are also habitats for animals. Ducks Unlimited loves wetlands, right?
In the Twin Cities with the lakes, they've replaced those wetlands that were around the lakes that were taken out for that reason.
Yeah.
To clean up the actual lake water.
That's right. It's a really major thing. There's also these things where they create, let's say you have new housing development. There's now a lot of rain gardening going on. They actually build a little pond in the midst of the development. The stormwater goes into that pond. The reeds grow up in this wetland area. And then they actually harvest those reeds and burn them. That's how they can control some of the pollution. Important stuff.
They don't let the people, I know in Minnesota, they don't let them take all their wetlands anymore and tile them so they can put crops into them. When they're there, a lot of times they have to leave them. They can't just go out and tile it all up so they can put a crop in.
People used to think that wetlands were where all the diseases came from, right? These swamps. In fact, the word wetland is right up there with watershed. A lot of people don't even know. Well, what are you talking about? You mean that bog over there? Yeah, well, that's a wetland. It's kind of a planner's term, not necessarily a term that comes naturally to us when we think about a swamp. And swamps used to be looked at as something you wanted to get rid of. Now they're saying, particularly in coastal areas, that's where the juvenile fish grow up. If you like to eat halibut or flatfish, those are basically going to start there.
Where
shrimp,
land,
all that stuff.
Where land and water come together, that's where life comes from.
That's right. I like it. I like if there's magic on our planet, it's contained in water. That's my favorite quote.
They got rid of a lot of the wildlife when they took all those out. There was no place for the wildlife, the pheasants and the ducks and all that to go.
Yeah, and that's
another thing they're trying to.
That's part of the reason you see things like the Isaac Walton League has a big watershed preservation thing, and Ducks Unlimited has a thing where they're reestablishing wildlife habitats, marshes, basically. A lot of people that used to be, you know, what we call sort of the hook and bullet crowd are now becoming our strongest conservationists. I think that's a wonderful thing. So the other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit that's related to watersheds and why it's a valuable thing to understand the watershed you live in is this whole notion of sense of place. That they find that people really need to be connected and knowledgeable about where they live. A lot of us are connected and some of us are not so well connected. And the people I always struggle with the most are military families, where they move a lot. They don't really get a chance to understand, particularly through many generations. It's kind of an American malaise, I think. It's not like we have that many people whose grandparents and great-grandparents lived in the same community. I'm just as guilty as anyone. I was raised in Chicago and third-generation American citizen, and you know, here I am, a resident of the city of Seattle. So, it's taken me a lot of study to really understand what is the area I live in naturally within the watershed. What were the cultures that were there before me? What were the values and things like that? And get connected up. I'm happy to see that my wife has joined me today because she's also been able to teach me a valuable lesson, which is we need to love these features of the land. It's not enough to pass laws or to say, no. You know, recycle or whatever. You need to get people enthusiastic and in love with the place where they live. And in Puget Sound, for example, where for the last 30 years, there have been continuous successions of state organizations charged with protecting Puget Sound. Well, I'd like to get people to say, you're going to do what to my Puget Sound? It's kind of like, what'd you call my mother? When we get to that level of commitment and appreciation and love. I mean, that's a hard word for an environmentalist to say, love of nature. That's what we really need to be working towards. It's an important thing. And you have a lot of people like Gary Snyder, the poet, who is very big on writing poems about sense of place, and he actually has created some kind of conservation groups themselves. And just getting a sense of what we have around us, what we value. So here's the other thing I love. This is, again, I have to apologize. I don't have one of these for everybody. So you might want to share. I'd be happy to make more printouts if anybody wants these. This is a really great quiz. It's called What's Your Ecological Address? And I guarantee you it's going to make almost all of us in this room feel even worse than when they came in and heard about the pollution. Because a lot of it is questions about the land we live in. And asking whether we know these things. These are like valuable questions, and a lot of them are kind of like, duh. So a lot of times, we don't know the answers. So I'm just going to read down the list a little bit to just give you an idea. Where does your tap water come from? In Seattle, it comes from the Cedar River watershed, which is far away. It used to be completely closed off to salmon, you know, salmon running upstream. We don't want salmon dying up there. That's where our water comes from. Now they've actually opened it up because the salmon are starting to get endangered. And they figured we have better systems for cleaning things anyhow. So I know the answer to that one. And I'm assuming the water here comes from Railroad Creek.
Copper.
Above the mine. See, there you go.
Above the mine.
Okay. Well, so that's an important thing to know. How many of you know where your water comes from, right? Yes. There's hands you do. Because if you don't, go out after when you get home and check into that.
You still have water.
So the other
time. Yeah, the water tower has to be filled.
Oh, yeah, water tower. There we go.
where did it come from to get into the tower?
Yeah, that's worth doing your investigative homework on.
Deep wells, I suppose.
Yeah, I would think that's probably true. Or reservoirs.
It depends on where you are. In Minneapolis and many of the surrounding suburbs, the water is taken out of the Mississippi River and then sent through.
Yeah, so it's a good thing to know where it comes from. And also, I would say the side question is, where did it used to come from?
Used
to,
yeah.
Because, yeah, like Los Angeles is getting its water from the state of Colorado.
Yep.
So.
And Eastern Washington.
Yeah, Eastern Washington. So this question number two, where does your garbage go?
Oregon.
That's right, our garbage goes to a landfill and then it's packaged up and transported down to Oregon to an even bigger landfill.
To Iowa,
yeah. See, these are kind of interesting questions, but a lot of times they're sort of like, I wouldn't have thought to ask. You know, they're valuable questions.
Waste management.
What was the last time a fire burned your area? I would have to say in Seattle, not a lot, quite some time ago.
Yeah. Over 100 years. My house is 110 years old, so it's well before that.
Yeah, and I think the reason this question is in here is because fire is a part of the natural cycle of things. In fact, it's only after people build houses and don't want them to burn down that wildfires became something to be avoided. They used to be, a lot of the stuff you'll see around here, the pines are those really, the ponderosa pines, with a really thick bark. That really thick bark is the survived fires, which you would go sweeping through here on a regular basis. Well, I won't go through this whole list here because it's pretty long. I like these extra questions, and these are actually from the Apps Handle curriculum at the very bottom. And that's actually Gary Snyder's project that he worked on. So some of these questions I think are trippy. How many days until the moon is full? I did see a little sliver of a moon a couple days ago. But, you know, people would normally have that kind of a connection if they really were paying attention. If they weren't, I mean, we're talking to a Chicagoan here who grew up in an area that was surrounded by cement. I mean, I'd start looking at the weeds growing in the cracks of the sidewalk and pretend that was wilderness or an empty lot or whatever. You get out of touch when you live in the big city.
I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and look out the kitchen window. What's
the answer? Is it 28? It's
there. Beautiful.
What is the lunar cycle?
Is it 28? What's the
answer? Yeah, 28 days. It's a lunar cycle. But quite frankly, I don't really have an idea when the next.
We're about halfway to the moon's out.
Okay. And I love this one too. From where are you reading this? Point north.
That way.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
The vast majority is going that way. I can take out my iPhone and tell you.
No, you couldn't.
Yeah, no, I couldn't.
Yeah, you could. Right. Because I've got one that uses the GPS.
Yeah, there you go. My GPS wouldn't be working. But, you know, those are things that, in fact, I'm always amazed when you look at the Mayan ruins. Mm-hmm. Those people, of course, it took them a lot longer. They didn't put up a house, a skyscraper in a year. Long, long time. They actually know how to play off of the light. And we have lost that ability because of the pace with which we construct things. So then you wind up having one big high-rise built. Oh, it's in the shadow of another high-rise. Duh. They moved it back a little bit. And this question, I think I can answer, were the stars out last night?
Yes,
yes,
I saw them.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, they were. We just couldn't see them.
I saw them at midnight.
Yeah, it was like partly cloudy towards the end of towards the wee hours. And you could see the stars.
We were up walking around.
So the last thing I wanted to say, and then I'm certainly open it for discussion, or let you all escape back into this beautiful weather we're having today, because I hear it might rain again tomorrow. Adding more water to the Railroad Creek watershed. What happened to that plan? I was telling you about the 1988 plan that I worked on, creating this non-point pollution plan and all that. Well, it got politicized. And people got funding to instigate the plans depending on how their water, what their watershed was, And people started inventing different kinds. They combined two watersheds into one watershed because now they have more people and more problems. They get more money for it. It got to be a very political thing. And I don't think any of the plans that were drafted were actually implemented. Kind of it left a bad taste in my mouth just about government process in general. And, you know, I don't want to say, oh, those environmentalists or oh, those bureaucrats, and just rule them out. We need all different kinds of processes here. But it did not result in keeping Puget Sound clean. Now there's a whole other organization working on kind of social media and lots of public education campaigns and all that. They're basically coming up against the same stuff, though, the stormwater runoff, the agricultural problems, all the stuff we were talking about earlier. It's still an issue, you know, 30 years later, and we still haven't really found the thing, because it really comes down to, in non-point pollution, individual responsibility. And that means, you know, use less, reduce, recycle, reuse kind of thing. And a lot of the hard choices, well, maybe I shouldn't be driving my car if it has a small oil leak in it. Maybe I should get that fixed or stop driving my car altogether. There are a lot of individual choices. So it's not a question of pointing at we need better rules or those farmers are bad or whatever. It's us. It's that pogo thing. We've met the enemy.
And they is us.
They is us. Exactly. And on that jolly note, that's all I have to say. So does anyone want to add something to this or have questions?
Yeah. Wendell Berry, who's a prolific writer and farmer and environmentalist, was this spring awarded the highest award in the humanities that the federal government bestows. It was given to him by President Obama. And at the Kennedy Center in April or something. And his lecture that he gave was called Everything Turns on Affection. And it gets back to the word love that you're talking about. Until we love the place where we are and are willing to defend it and care for it and love it, then everything turns on that.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's an intellectual exercise.
Right. But as long as we're willing to kind of sacrifice the land for some kind of abstract good like money, well, we're signing our own.
Yeah.
I want to respond to the idea that it's individual responsibility. It certainly is. And I understand the frustration with politics. But what we do politically determines what kind of choices we have to clean things up. Point of fact, We live in Minneapolis. He works 20 miles away. Well, not that far. 12, 13. He does not drive to work. He can do that because we have a public transportation system that clumsily gets him there.
Slowly.
And he's committed to that, right? If we don't have public transportation systems, which are among the most politicized things that we spend money on, then people don't have the choice not to drive to work. And so part of what I think we need to really work on, because I think we're really good at the individual relationship between me and God and me loving this place. Maybe not good enough, but we're pretty good at it. But part of what we need to work on is I love this place and my neighbors enough to join together with them to do the things that will give us the choices.
Well said. I'm not going to argue with that one. And I guess I'm going to actually go back to the expression I learned from Richard Swanson's talk today, a GOS, a gross oversimplification.
No, so, I'm not feeling like I'm hostile at all here. It's just that I think there is a mood right now because government is so frustrating right now. There's this mood to throw our hands up and say, well, you know, it's better if we just don't deal with the government. We don't have that choice if we really want to solve a big problem.
Yeah, and actually that's an individual thing as well. Attend public meetings, share your views.
Yeah.
And you're right, and work with others. Because, you know, if everyone bands together, they can actually create a whole other node on the transportation chain. Mm-hmm. We live in an area on the West Coast that's just, you know, driving a car is your unalienable right. Mm-hmm. And it's really, we've had a lot of people be really slow to get to that idea that, well, gee, maybe they should be taking a bus with other people.
And it pollutes, and you don't spend that time getting to know other people, and it frustrates you and makes you tense, and that means you take more drugs that go right into the water.
Being someone who's in the business of creating solutions to problems like this, there aren't very many, if any, of these problems we've talked about that we don't know what the solution is. But until such time as people are willing to make the financial and the lifestyle sacrifices to implement those solutions, we're up here in the woods talking to ourselves.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to actually respond to that. You think it's not all that bleak, and to some extent I agree with her nephew, the farmer. There are lots of places where there are solid, intentional efforts made to ameliorate some of these problems. Someone who spoke about the sewage overflow. Was 10 years ago, Minneapolis separated the street system from the sewer system. No more sewage overflow.
Mm-hmm.
It took a lot of money. It took a lot of years of work. But it was the will within the will of the government to do that. And only the government can do that. So you got to get involved in your government. Parking lots are now being made in lots of places by local building codes to be permeable. Okay, and there are lots and lots of places where you're encouraged to make your own patio permeable. Okay? So these things are going on all over, all the time, a little bit at a time, a little here, a little there, but they add up to large amounts. And no, the problem is not solved, but the problem is being worked on.
Yeah, I think we have a lot. I mean, I look back at all the wonderful technologies that were totally off the beam, and we're now unveiling them from the 50s.
Yeah.
And we're talking about hydropower dams on the Columbia River. We're talking about, nuclear power plants. Everyone always thought this is the answer, you know, based on the technologies, fish hatcheries, based on the technologies and the understanding of the day. Well, I think our understanding of the way things work has gotten a lot more sophisticated. We're a lot less likely to just think the answer is in a cement structure. So I think we do have a better chance.
Let's
take numbers here.
You may have already mentioned this, but the Thornton Creek watershed, whose headwaters is under the Northgate Mall park that we live in. He talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, it's, 40 years, and now there's these beautiful trees that are bringing in old-growth birds. And this, there's hope for this little urban watershed, and it's just like people really can, if they get excited about it and care about it, they can come together and really, really change something. But I think in Washington, we have, in this state, we have templates of a couple watersheds that have successfully created... a lot of it's been governments, too, working together, too. I mean, there's been a lot of collaborating that's been positive, so...
You've had your hand up for a long time.
It's okay. I wanted just to talk a little bit about local transportation. In Oregon, we have urban growth boundaries, and in order to build outside of that boundary, you need to get some sort of legal... It's a long process, and so it's Portland remains compact. All the cities in Oregon remain pretty compact. It's higher density, but it also makes it easier to plan for TriMet on public transportation. It's a lot easier to get around as a result. When I go back into Minnesota, my jaw just drops when I see how the sprawl has gone, and I'm impressed that somebody here is so committed to using the transportation there, because it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard.
Well, yeah, there's a whole philosophy now of kind of what they call urban infill.
Yeah.
It's actually better to have denser cities and less of that sprawl, because it's impossible to serve those areas, even for not just for transportation, but fire services, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll explain, actually, my motivation to do that. It's economic.
Yes.
For $2.25, I can get to work. I can almost spend that much money driving 12 miles for gasoline alone, let alone car repairs and oil changes.
Insurance.
Yeah. To me, it's even more than a wash. I get more out of it than I put in.
Unless you get to read.
Yes.
Let's get this guy, and then we'll come over to you guys.
Not all. Most of us in the room were probably remember Rachel Carson and Silent Spring in the 1960s. In a lot of ways, our cities back in the 60s and 70s were dirtier than they are now, thanks to things like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, which actually were enacted under Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there was a bipartisan, which is sad, we don't have that now, there was a bipartisan commitment to cleaning things up in conservation. That's when the Cuyahoga River caught fire near Cleveland, and now it's a national recreation area. There was a real commitment back then to say things got really bad, and there was a collective will, both individual and collective will, to say, let's fix this. So we passed some important laws back then, which stood the test of time. I remember we lived in Denver for 15 years. The smog in Denver used to be horrible, the inversion layer that happened in the wintertime when the air got trapped. Yeah. Because of regulation in the state, which has emissions that you have to go get your car tested and have proper emissions, the air is cleaner than it used to be. It's a lot cleaner. Sure, there's more to go. There's better things we could still do. But I'm just saying, I think if there's collective will, things can improve.
That's right. Well said.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I wanted to say,
and we can continue this conversation over.
Like, for example, in Seattle, to take the bus to downtown Seattle took longer and cost more money than if I drove my own car. And, Seattle has some topographic issues about transportation because there's a gigantic lake in the middle of the area. There's lots of, there's 34 creeks that feed into Lake Washington. There's a couple of rivers. There's elevation changes almost from 0 to 2,000 feet within the whole Puget Sound area. So you can't lay out a grid pattern like you can in Chicago or Minneapolis Minneapolis has a lot of lakes too. But topographically, it's challenging to build a efficient transportation system in Seattle, but taking the bus to downtown Seattle is not necessarily a money saver or a time saver. Now, with gas being almost $4 a gallon, maybe it's getting closer to that. But bus fares have also skyrocketed at the same time. So I think it's great that in Minneapolis they can build a transportation system that's cheaper than driving your car, because in Seattle you can't do it.
Well, and then a lot of people take it downtown as well, mm-hmm. and it's still the same $2.35. But $4.50 a day, you can't buy parking for $4.50 a day. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot
of parking fee was outside.
And a lot of what we're driven, a lot of what we are driven by in our choices is economics. Yeah, that's what you're both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sure.
You had a question. Yeah. Or something.
Now this pipeline that's been proposed.
Oil pipeline through Montana. What effect will that have on the environment and water? I know a little bit about it just by reading it. Uh-huh. It's basically taking tar sands from Alberta, Canada, and shipping it down to refineries in the Gulf. But most of that oil is actually destined outside the United States. Mm. Most small oil producers won't have access to that pipeline. There's a lot of small producers in Kansas and eastern Colorado and other places that need to kind of ship their product out and they won't have access. So it's not a totally clear yes or no answer on that pipeline.
Yeah.
There's a lot of issues with that. The other side of that, though, is if Canada doesn't send their tar sands sludge down through that way, they're going to send it west to British Columbia to ship it to China. Because that's the other alternative, is for Canada to market that sludge oil into a port on the BC coast in a pristine area to ship it to China. So there's no easy answer to this. Tar sands, to me, though, tells us if that's economical to mine them, that says that we are at peak oil or just over the other side of it. We better find another alternative fuel to be running our things on besides oil in our lifetime or our kids' lifetime, because economics is dictating all that.
Yes.
Right now, of course, but oil's dropping down now under $80 a barrel. Some of that's due to natural gas conversion, because that's more plentiful now. So anyway, there's no easy answer. We need a national energy policy that has a lot of all of the above kind of things, but there's no easy answer in that pipeline. It's a political football, unfortunately. It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
I think another issue with the hard-to-reach oil and the new ways of getting natural gas is that water is intensively used in the process of extracting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, everybody's putting it back under the assumption that it's been cleaned up. There's not enough checking to see if it really has been cleaned up. And it's been cleaned up of the things we know to check for. And so part of what this is that kind of ongoing, changing, flowing reality that we live in, that we're always constantly learning and things change. But the more we can conserve things like that we know pollute, both in the process of extracting and in the process of getting them out like coal and oil and even natural gas, the less damage there is to the water.
I'm going to call for an end to our discussion here. I heard the bell ring. And the round three. And I'd love to encourage you all to continue this conversation outside of this room, because there's lots of different ways we can go from here. And when I worked on I passed out the list of the ecological address questions. When I worked on that project, that was a result of about a year's worth of thought with people from all different salmon-bearing cultures. So we have Siberians and Japanese and all sorts of people contributing. But basically, it came down to people sharing their thoughts and their feelings, and that's really the way to go, I think. So I think if you're all here for a few more days, look at this area here, think about home and what works and what doesn't work in your own environment. It's that Voltaire thing about plant your own garden. That's what I'm encouraging. So I'd love to continue conversation. If you want to strike up a conversation with me about anything, you know me, I like to talk.